22 years old, third-year university student, a young age filled with limitless possibilities, full of potential. On January 14, 1987, a young student attending Seoul National University tragically died after undergoing police interrogation. The deceased young man's name was Park Jong-char, and his death became a catalyst for the democratization movement here in South Korea. Today we'll be discussing the background of this very unfortunate death and the impact it's had on the history of South Korea's democratization movement. For this, Professor John DeMoya of Seoul National University joins us here once again. Professor DeMoya, good to see you once again.
Thank you very much for having me again.
So you yourself, being from Seoul National University, I'm sure...
Which is an unusual identification, but yes.
Yes. an elite school, whether you be a student or a professor there.
I get very interesting reactions from Koreans when I tell them what I do.
Yeah, but not a lot of people will kind of link Seoul National University to this particular person.
Yes.
Unless we talk about the history.
Absolutely.
Of democratization movements here in South Korea. But let's first, my dad's always talked about this. You know, it's funny because him as a university student basically filled with protests.
Sure.
Which was ironic because my grandfather, his father, was a police officer cracking down on protests. And so you can kind of imagine.
I was just going to say, you must have had some interesting family dinners.
It was not a very happy family dinner.
Sure.
But there was a lot of this.
Yeah.
A lot of student activity going on. What were some of the typical student activist actions during the early 1980s? Also, what was the Minjung theology supporting the democratization movement?
Sure. On the basic level, and then I'll talk about Minjung, but just student activities first, you might have someone at the most mild level trying to form a reading group, mm-hmm. which might sound very neutral, but they were reading things that in Korea at the time were probably banned, maybe including things like Western theory, perhaps even reading Marx in a Korean translation, which again, in the context of the time, would make the government very upset. Even more, to give you an example off the top of my head that I know was banned, if you're familiar with University of Chicago, Bruce Cumings' History of Korea, Volume 1 and 2, it's the big volume on the Korean War, the reason this book was so controversial was that it talked about the U.S. occupation, it talked about the U.S. and Korea in complex ways where they didn't always agree, mm-hmm. that challenged the narrative of, wow, we've always been friends and the U.S. saved us during the Korean War. So my understanding is that if you had a copy of that book in Samizdat, illegal copied version as a Korean student at the time, you could literally be arrested for holding the text.
Oh, wow.
So that reading the text actually was a very transgressive act. That's on the more mild end.
Okay.
On the more serious end, I've had former students tell me, and, you know, people my age, 40s and 50s, that they knew how to make Molotov cocktails, that they actually did participate in demonstrations from the mild end of holding up a sign to actually throwing potential gasoline bombs at police in the extremes of the mid to late 80s.
Yeah.
So some serious hardcore stuff. The other stuff you'll get too, because people will talk about the gender aspects and these are kind of interesting. You get some accounts of Korean females participating just as the males. Others, accounts that are a little more critical, will argue that there were, as in many of these things, gendered roles where female students were asked to photocopy to do more supporting things. And of course, they've complained retroactively. But again, you have everything from just circulating texts and discussing ideas as one will do in your 20s and it's cool, to, wow, we should translate this into action. We should actually be out in the streets. And some of them were. So a former colleague of mine who once told me about being a Fulbright at Yonsei in the mid 80s said, we had a deal with the police.
Yeah.
Shincheon Rotary. You stay inside the gates of the Cheongmun of Yonsei, if you know the main campus, and inside the gates, you're fine. But you walk out of the gates and you start going towards Shincheon Rotary, and you've got your kind of music and maybe your doll, the traditional masks, and the police start showing up and saying, okay, now you're kind of out in public and this is maybe when the tear gas starts to fly. That was fairly normal for the early to mid-80s, Chunduan.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that Yonsei University was sort of where a lot of these demonstrations and protests happened, because that was the one thing that was baffling, because when my dad was first explaining to me how he spent his college days protesting and things like that. He would always talk about being in Shincheon. And
yeah, I was just going to say, Shincheon always comes up.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, wait, yeah. You didn't go to Yonsei University. You were nowhere near that school. But right. He said that's where everyone came together. It didn't matter whether you were a student of Yonsei University or whatever, two-year community college that he went to. That was sort of the focal point of all these student demonstrations.
Yeah, and if I had to guess on that point, and I also don't know like a definitive answer to it, but my guess would be the proximity, as you just said, you're not necessarily Yonsei, but the proximity of Hyundai, Iwa University, mm-hmm. and Sogang means you've already got, 60,000-70,000 students in the area, plus whoever wants to come in.
Oh, yeah.
Plus the proximity to City Hall. I imagine that's part of the appeal of kind of moving and marching. And then, as you know, famously, it's apocryphal, but it's worth mentioning in this context. Solde used to have the old campus up by Taeyongno. Those students used to way back march from the other, also be accessible to City Hall. And with the move to Kwanak in 1975, because we talk about this all the time, whether mm-hmm. it's apocryphal or not, the idea was that the Solde students would be isolated from any City Hall activity. And to be honest, we are kind of an island down in Kwanak, so yeah.
It is a very isolated campus.
Yes, and we are painfully aware of that.
And just because there is a train station named after it doesn't mean that it's anywhere close
which, as you know, is several kilometers away.
It is.
As every person who's ever gone off of Solde Ipkwin says, where's Solde?
Yeah, I learned that the hard way many, many years ago trying to visit. Let's talk about Gwangju, city of Gwangju, because it is a city that is often mentioned when it comes to democratization
Absolutely.
Movements. Let's go over what happened in Gwangju in 1980.
Okay. Then this is still one of the major turning points of recent Korean history, and obviously still very controversial.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that with Park Chung-hee being assassinated in October of 79, with the transition to Chun Doo-hwan seizing power, which is the subject of a current popular movie, that this was controversial and a lot of people weren't quite sure how to approach it, and that what this means in the city of Gwangju in the spring of 1980, I believe April into May, you have a city that has a long history of being linked to Kim Dae-jung and opposition politics, even as far back as the Japanese colonial period, pushed back against the Japanese. So with that history, a movement in 1980, to push back, certainly let the government know that they weren't going to necessarily accept what had just happened, this transition mm-hmm. to Chun. And in short terms, a brief moment of government suppression, the people define the people, we could definitely talk about what that means, but take power briefly for a couple of days, seize power. And with that, and this is where the controversy comes in, a violent oppression of that people's takeover by the government to put it down in May of 1980, resulting in still, no one's quite sure how many people died and how many people were killed, but a large number of people were certainly injured. Where this is also really interesting, and again, historians have now looked at this, is to recognize that probably a lot of the Gwangju guys who were in that movement, some of them might have previously been in Vietnam or certainly did military service. They knew how to use weapons. That's why when they broke into the armory, they were able to organize themselves, unlike people in another country who might not know how to use weapons or handle themselves. These were Korean men who definitely knew how to do this. This is part of the reason there was such a violent suppression. And then the other thing, too, what did people know then? There are rumors that some of the soldiers who helped in the putting down were told that this was a communist/North Korean uprising, so that they really believed that they were helping to suppress and not realizing necessarily, as we might think now, that these are our own citizens. Those, again, that's still very much the controversial, although as far as I know, there has never been shown a link to any kind of, left, well, certainly not any communist North Korean inspired activity.
And that's something that we saw even starting from the Syng Man Rhee, administration, right? I mean, they're putting the fear of communism, and a lot has to do with the fact that, well, let's face it, after the Korean War, right? I mean, what sparked the Korean War?
But even to be fair, just before the war, with something like Cheju.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You cannot be communist and nationalist if you are against the government. You must be communist. You must be pro-North Korean. You're your problem.
And so the government would always use communism or people spreading communist idea as a reason for them to be able to use full force to kind of shut them down and so forth.
And I get it. If you're a soldier and this is your access to information, and if you're a soldier, you're already patriotic and you're used to doing what you're told, you're told that this is a communist-inspired uprising, I get that you're not probably going to even question that, or if you do, you're going to keep those reservations to yourself pretty quickly.
And what's interesting is that kind of still, that idea still lingers, where if you are kind of a supporter of the more liberal administration, they will call you a communist, right?
Yes.
And it's still kind of in the society today.
Absolutely. These things, the last 70, 80 years of Korean history are still being very much actively contested.
Yeah, yeah.
It's why my job is very interesting.
It is a very interesting job. Let's talk about, because we're going to talk about all these student movements, how the government handled these student activities and try to curb their demonstrations and protests.
Sure. I think on a more, let's kind of like cover the spectrum again of like hardcore versus sort of more mild but more interesting forms. Mm-hmm. I'll start with, I mean, the more hardcore, as we suggested, if you're out in the streets firing Molotov cocktails at police, it's obvious that you actually are breaking the law and you are potentially a violent offender. So I imagine short-term detention to long-term detention, depending on the severity of your offense. With that also, not just those offenders, but limitations on public expression. If you are brave enough to publish things that are deemed by the government to be anti-government, you are probably going to be called in for an interview at the very least. Mm-hmm. Let me just think of other things. And also on the shorter end, just to give you, and this isn't totally apocryphal, but to give you where it comes from so that you'll... Bruce Cummings, again, the same historian, has a nice, you'll get the story really quickly, story about when he was at University of Washington in the 70s, so this is just a decade earlier, but he had a student who was a PhD student at Washington, Korean, and he was called back to Namsan at his graduation, and here's what they did, but this is beautiful, here's what they did to him. They didn't torture him in any way. They sat him down while he was sweating under, under a light, the classic, and they said, "You wrote this in your dissertation, page one, why?" And they went through this for several hours, laboriously reading his dissertation. And at the end of this interrogation, probably from late night into early morning, they said to him, "What we're trying to show you here is, this is an introductory visit. We're not going to hurt you, but you do understand we know everything you did when you were in the U.S. We know everything you're thinking now. You want to be careful not to have to come back here." And to give you the thing, there was a widespread rumor, and this is just rumor, but I'll throw it out there, that if there was a small group of Korean students doing a PhD at this university and there were five of them, possibly at least one of your friends was consulting or at least reporting back on a friendly basis to the KCIA, so that you have that kind of softer mental control that gets into your own head to the more active police suppression a decade later. That whole spectrum, I get that. If you're, and by the way, this is not just Korea, but to give you the historical analogy, there are rumors that the Kuomintang in Taiwan did this in the 60s and 70s as well. Similarly, you're in this liberal overseas environment, but just be aware that we know what you're thinking. When you come back home, you got to watch your ass.
So someone is always watching you and listening to what's going on. And for our listeners out there, just to put it out there, when he means Namsan, they're not up in Namsan Mountain putting in locks of love and expressing, enjoying a nice little stroll on the area there. I know very much about the interrogation building located in the foots of Namsan because I worked at a radio station many years ago.
Okay.
And that radio station was that very building.
Wow.
They turned that building into a radio station later on.
I did not know that.
And so I remember since the very first day I went to work there, I took a cab and the cab driver goes, "You know what that building used to be?" And I was like,
probably got some like weird vibes. Like, who do you work for?
It's a radio station. I don't know. It's my first day. And you tell me the historical aspects of things, how people used to be going there in like, torture chambers and things like that.
Precisely. The classic is the room with the light bulb. And depending on what, I don't even imagine just things that they could do psychologically and possibly physically.
Yeah, and so it was not a happy place. So when he says Namsan, we're not talking about, the Namsan that all of our listeners are aware of now. Let's go into the focus of today's topic, Park Jong-chul.
Yep.
For many Koreans, he is a name to remember, especially when it comes to democracy movements here in the Korea. What were sort of his circumstances in which he was arrested? Because he was just, again, a young Seoul National University student.
Yeah, my understanding of this is that he was arrested at some point in early 1987. He was a student, I think linguistics, but definitely a Seoul Day student. Mm-hmm. And his crime primarily was one of participating in these student movements, circulating names and things. And he was brought in for an interrogation. And my understanding is that they essentially were asking him the classic to name names. Not only do we know what you're doing, it's not necessarily the severity of that, but could you please tell us whom are you in contact with? What's the extent of your network? Presumably accusations of, are you in some sort of communist cell or certainly left-wing cell? And that for a variety of reasons, presumably of his own choosing, this young man chose not to talk, chose to probably identify only himself in his own activities, mm-hmm. and that this greatly upset the individuals who were interrogating him. And we do have to remember, this is the height of complete militarized control. This is also at a time in Korea when there was a nightly, I can't remember if it was midnight or 1 a.m., but you had the curfew.
So
this would be, I mean, this was not extreme at this time. This was perfectly acceptable police behavior at this time.
You weren't allowed to have skirts in a certain length.
Yes,
you
couldn't have, the classic Dunsulk. And the hair.
Guys couldn't have.
Yep. I show my students the pictures. One of the Seoul City History volumes actually has a policeman measuring a girl's skirt in the street. And they're like, wasn't the policeman arrested for being, you know, his behavior? And they're like, no. It was perfectly okay to police that.
And I remember looking at pictures of my dad when he was younger and he had longer hair. And I was like, did he
get hassled?
Well, the thing was, he said that was his way of going against the government.
Got it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so
the safer way.
Yeah. But I mean, also he did get arrested. And
he wasn't reading communist texts. That's what I'm saying.
The arrest is one thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is where it gets controversial.
Sure.
I talked about the Namsan, the building, all the very controversial things that happened with the police and things like that. Do we know what exactly happened to Park Jong-chul during his interrogation?
Well, I know we know pretty comfortably how he died. And I could talk about that if you want.
Of course.
How we got from that to an interrogation to ratcheting up that level, I don't think we know with rigorous detail. My guess is that his refusal to talk, to divulge further names, to give information, probably resulted in an incremental ratcheting up where, I'm guessing the police probably meant to scare him seriously, but not necessarily to kill him in the way that he was killed.
I know that if you hear some of the testimonies from, you know, student activists who went through this, there was waterboarding going on.
Yes, this is what I've heard repeatedly. The so-called water cure.
Right. Electrocution.
Yep. Being wired up to things.
Yeah.
The version I've heard is that his body gave out under repeated exposures to waterboarding/water cure, which, if you know, is essentially of a cloth placed over your mouth and nostrils, water's poured on it to simulate the experience of drowning. And I guess if you do that long enough, the body can't keep coming back from that.
No. And I'm
guessing it was probably done in mistake, but ultimately, he came in and somewhere in the next morning, he was not a physically functioning human being.
No, absolutely not. And so this is why January 14th, 1987, this is when, again, Park Jong-chul, the young age of 22, a third year university student, died through police interrogation. This sparked, again, sort of, this was a catalyst for further democratization movement here in South Korea. When we talk about democracy movement, we always talk about the infamous May 15, 1980 in Gwangju.
Yeah.
But there's also the June democracy movement as well. I'm assuming June of 1987.
Absolutely.
Following the death of Park Jong-chul, what was the June democracy movement?
Sure. The height of the June democracy movement is both Park Jong-chul, and then I'm going to apologize because I do forget the name, but a little bit later in the spring, probably.
There's another student.
Yes, another student who's hit with a tear gas canister and he passes away. So students are already obviously trying to protest and trying to capitalize on this. More specifically, this is tied to the visibility of the movement. It's starting to hit the international press. And also retroactively, people have talked about this a lot. They know that the Seoul Olympics is coming for the next year, so that Korea is getting increasing press coverage so that the students can essentially potentially embarrass the government with these protests. I don't think this ever would have happened, but there was some idea that if they embarrass the government sufficiently enough, the IOC will step in and say, okay, we can't have the Olympics in Korea. It's not a stable place. But that mere threat itself gives the students a certain amount of leverage in pushing on things.
Lee Han-yeol, there you go. Lee Han-yeol.
That's it. Thank you. Yes. Student, yeah. And he was Yonsei, I believe.
Lee Han-yeol was, I'm going to get into this.
Sure.
Yeah, he was Yonsei. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
I knew there was a Yonsei student as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this was when he was seriously injured when a tear gas grenade penetrated his skull.
And right. Again, I'm guessing accidentally firing into a crowd. I mean, not accidentally, but not trying to kill him. And then it did, yeah.
But it still did.
Oh, absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so go ahead with
your... So I also wanted to, before I did June, and I forgot to mention it earlier, so here's the perfect time to bring back, Minjung.
Yeah.
Minjung is literally, Minjung in terms of democratization, I won't translate it literally in terms of the word, but it's like bottom-up history.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Koreans have been dominated by first colonialism, then by the American occupation, and now by militarized government, so that students, even before this, were doing things like going to farms and factories and working in jobs they wouldn't normally work to kind of show identification across class lines.
Yeah.
I don't know if they really thought that this would transform the lives of workers, but showing them you have some role, you have some agency. And so with Minjung and now coming back to June 1987, students along with some workers and ultimately by the streets of, sorry, by the height of June, the so-called white-collar workers will start to join the students, showing that quote-unquote average Koreans have agency, can write their own stories. The story does not have to be about great men, so to speak, like Park Chung-hee, that these students combined with workers, combined with white-collar colleagues in offices can actually together form some sort of coalition that can actually transform Korea for better or worse, that informed the mass protest movement, not only of June 1987, but in theory also just a few years ago, also with Candlelight, the right. Same type of idea that you build across class lines, across all kinds of differences to show that there are commonalities that are more important than that.
We can argue that, again, South Korea was formed through many of these protests,
mm-hmm.
right? You can say that with the independence movement during the Japanese colonial
times. Oh, absolutely,
times,
absolutely.
Right? And I mean, it takes back to that.
And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of historians now date South Korea national origin not to 1948, but precisely to 1919
yeah.
because of that.
Yeah, exactly. And so, which is why, and then we saw, like you said, the Candlelight Revolution and so forth. And we have this kind of culture within.
Absolutely.
Right? And, you know, you want to fight for what you believe in, which is why, you know, there's also a lot of protests and demonstrations on a daily basis.
Can I do one quick injection here?
Sure,
just to give you an apocalyptic example?
Absolutely.
Okay. So when I first came here in late 95, I started teaching at YBM in an English school in early 96. And a lot of my male students at the time, when I did the normal first night, who are you, introduce yourself, mm-hmm. would do the I would so-and-so, but I really didn't have a college major. And I would say, well, why not? And this is January, February 96. They'd say, well, when I was in college, I was basically in the street every day. And I didn't have a context for that at the time.
Yeah.
Now I wish I could go back and do a lot more oral history interviews because I was getting people basically in the transformation process from having been activist and undong, you know, protester to white collar worker by the early 90s because now we're in a different period. But so, yeah, that was a common trope of I had a major and I graduated, but that really wasn't what I did.
Absolutely.
And I
not.
Now get that they were actually not being sarcastic with me. They were probably spending the bulk of their time exactly protesting.
Yeah. And, you know, my dad's told me before, and going back to what my dad
said,
you know, a lot was learned through some of the things that he went through. He said when he was arrested, he was given what is called the 빨간주 or the red line, which means he has a criminal record, which prevented him.
I was just going to say, it hurt you. Yeah,
and it prevented him from getting a job later on, which ultimately later on, that was all forgiven. And, you know,
but you don't know that at the time, right?
Right, at the time. Right. And so he said, you know, his career started off. It took off a lot later than it should have. But
precisely, this fits beautifully what I was just saying. Yeah.
But you don't have that now anymore because we now live in a society where we're able to kind of do all this as long as you don't break any rules. But we don't remember all of this.
No.
We live in a society where we can freely protest as long as it's in the limits of legal being illegal.
No, And to your point, really quickly, again, just to give you a weirdness of my own, to tying this, now having been here since on and off since 95, 96, and then back in the early 2000s, and then the last couple of years at Seoul Day, when I tell my students about Kim Il-sung, and I wasn't even there for the more serious protests, my student's standard response is, "Prof, we weren't born yet." And I'm like, wow, A, a memory issue, but B, it's really funny to me because I have to raise my hand to them and say, you do realize that things happened before you. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Now, the memory is absolutely... Korean 20-somethings, this is actually probably in a textbook for them, and it's weird for me that they don't have any palpable memory of the regular protest that basically one generation earlier went through.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is why it's all the more important that we cover figures like Park Jong-chul and Lee Han-yeol, who also lost their lives because of this democracy movement. Professor Demoy, I want to thank you very much once again. Great history lesson for all of our listeners out there. Have a fantastic rest of your week, and looking forward to our next history lesson next week.
Thank you very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.